Ici.
It's Thursday, January 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, world markets slide on lower oil prices.
As OPEC's biggest producer, Saudi Arabia and Iraq, continue to pump oil near record rates, supplies will continue to exceed demand for some time to come.
Also ahead, a terrorist attack kills dozens at a Pakistan university. Will negotiations on Syria's future go ahead as planned? And we'll chat with astronaut Scott Kelly, who's just about to end his year on the space station. That's all on today's International Edition. It was a wild day for traders on U.S. stock markets Wednesday as major indices fell more than 3% at one point before recovering significantly by the close. Experts blame the volatility on plunging oil prices, China's economic slowdown, and a pessimistic outlook for the overall global economy this year. At the end of trading, the S&P was off 1.2%, while the Dow fell about 1.6%. Stocks in Germany were down 2.8%, while key indexes in France and Britain dropped into bear territory, down nearly 3.5%. On Wednesday, Tokyo's Nikkei fell nearly 4%, Hong Kong's Hang Seng dropped 3.5%, and China's Shanghai Index was down 1.3% in midweek. As I mentioned, one of the factors in the worldwide market slide is the lower price of crude oil. The price of oil dropped below $27 a barrel, which hurt the stock prices of energy companies that are important parts of some stock indexes. International Edition's Ira Melman spoke with Toro Bossini, a senior oil market analyst of the Oil Industry and Markets Division at the International Energy Agency in Paris, about what the current oil market means for investors in the long term.
The drop in oil prices from over $115 in mid 2014 to below $30 currently has clearly started to slow down global oil supply growth. What we're seeing is that oil production is still outpacing demand, and oil continues to pile up in storage tanks all over the world. What we're saying is that while the growth in non-OPEC supply has slowed from the record highs that we saw in 2014, we're still the impact of lower prices on supply is taking time to filter through, and we're still producing more oil than we consume. So what we're seeing is that despite this sharp slowdown in growth in non-OPEC supplies since 2014, overall the market balances are not looking much better in 2016. We're forecasting non-OPEC production to decline by 600,000 barrels a day this year, but still, as OPEC's biggest producer, Saudi Arabia and Iraq, continue to pump oil near record rates, we do not see them backing down from the policy to defend market share, supplies will continue to exceed demand for some time to come.
What about the addition of Iran now that the sanctions have been lifted? They're estimating, 30 to 50 million barrels of oil from Iran. What's that going to do to further complicate the situation?
So as the sanctions, the lifting of the nuclear sanctions on Iran were very much anticipated to come in sometime early this year. But as you say, Iran's return to the market that complicates the picture, and it adds even more downward pressure to an already oversupplied market. So we believe that Iran has made considerable progress in preparing its own network and lining up buyers for its oil. And we think that they can add about 300,000 barrels a day of additional crude to market by as soon as the end of the first quarter. And Iran has, our estimate is that Iran has about 34 million barrels a day of condensate stored on tankers offshore, and they would want to clear that overhang as quickly as possible.
That lowers prices even more, is that correct?
A lot of the impact of Iran returning to market, we believe, has already been priced in to the market. It was highly expected, and so it doesn't come as a surprise.
Geographically, what are the hardest hit areas as far as lower oil prices, even if as they continue to get lower, what does it mean to the economies of these countries in these areas?
Oil producers in Africa, Venezuela, Nigeria, Angola, the Middle Eastern countries, where they have a very high portion of their national revenue is dependent on oil prices, is clearly very difficult. We're seeing Russia was not only hit by lower oil prices, but also by international sanctions last year, and the Russian economy is in recession.
That's Toril Boroni of the International Energy Agency speaking with International Edition's Ira Melman. Time now to check out what people are saying online about the plunge in oil prices and its consequences for things like retirement and stock funds. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins us with details and its impact on the stock market. Hi, G.
Hi, Dave. So this is the situation in a nutshell. Crude oil prices in the U.S. fell 6.7% Wednesday to below $27 a barrel during the trading day. Like you said earlier, that's the lowest figure since May 2003. That dealt a big blow to all the major U.S. stock indices. At one point, the Dow plunged more than 560 points, the S&P 500 and Nasdaq slid more than 3% respectively. So not the best scenario for investors, but Twitter users are finding humor even in the darkest of the trading times.
Okay, well, let's have some examples. What are they saying?
Sure, one user with a handle @GasBuddyGuy wrote this tweet. Dinner for two at Olive Garden, now more expensive than a barrel of WTI crude oil. But at least there is unlimited breadsticks. For our listeners outside of the United States, Olive Garden is an Americanized Italian chain restaurant, and WTI stands for West Texas Intermediate. That's a grade of crude oil used in a benchmark oil pricing, along with the Brent crude oil and others.
The Dubai crude oil is also mentioned quite a bit. The major stock indexes fell sharply with so many people going on selling sprees. But there are always some buyers who take advantage of those lower prices, right?
Absolutely, and that's precisely what's different about what happened Wednesday. The market has been going only one direction since the beginning of the year, and that's south. Usually when this happens, bargain buyers jump in to buy the shares at discount prices. These guys usually include sovereign wealth funds who can afford to wait out the volatility and reap the benefits decades later. What's different this time is that the sovereign wealth funds are also under pressure. Many of these funds were built on oil fortunes, so when the oil prices plummet, they also suffer. It's a vicious cycle. Before I go, I want to add that biotech and chipmakers supported the tech-heavy Nasdaq index, erasing the initial 3.7 plunge seen earlier in the day. Back to you.
Thanks for the wrap-up, G. You can follow G on Twitter. Her handle is @GAbbyLee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. She also tweets from our International Edition account. We're @VOA_IE. Coming up, talks on the Syrian civil war are scheduled to start next week, but who's going to represent the opposition? That and more coming up on International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met in Switzerland Wednesday with uncertainty over the timing of talks on Syria's future and the humanitarian crisis in that country high on the agenda. The talks are scheduled to start next week, but one sticking point is who exactly will represent the Syrian opposition. Russia and Iran back the Assad regime and have rejected attempts by Saudi Arabia to organize the Syrian opposition delegation for the talks. I spoke with VOA's State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins about the talks and what it would mean if they are postponed.
Secretary Kerry pressed Lavrov, first of all, to have Russia use its influence with President Assad to ensure the immediate access of humanitarian aid to the Syrians that are in need. Lavrov indicated that Russia was working on this concern. But they also talked about this January 25th start date that you mentioned for the UN-led talks on a political transition in Syria. And there is a great deal of concern that this date may slip because there's been no agreement on the makeup of the Syrian opposition group that would meet with President Assad's government. Even today, the UN envoy who would lead this talk, Stephen De Mistura, said he believed negotiators could start talks on the 25th, but then he said start talks, but perhaps not on the 25th. But he added that there was a need to maintain pressure and momentum.
There was an opposition representative group formed in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. To give our listeners a little bit of background, Saudi Arabia, like the United States and Europe, opposes the Assad regime. However, Russia and Iran are supportive of the Assad regime. And Iran's foreign minister said today that his nation would not take part in any talks that involved what he called al-Qaeda terrorists, referring to some of the groups in this opposition representative council that was formed in Saudi Arabia. Is there a way out of this? And what does the United States see as its role to get this process or to continue this process?
The United States, to try to keep this process on track, is trying to meet with some of the key players, in addition to meeting with Lavrov later on during this trip. Kerry will meet with his Saudi counterpart, Foreign Minister Joubert, to also raise the issue of moving these talks forward. The big issue is that different players have different ideas on the makeup of this opposition group. Russia, which, you know, as you mentioned, is a key ally of the Syrian government, has been backing one plan for the opposition group. But then Saudi Arabia, another key player in these talks, has different ideas on the makeup of the group. And then there's also another factor, and that is that the Syrian government has said that it wants to see the final opposition group list before launching any talks. And that could be an indication that the government may want to reserve the right to possibly object to names or groups on the list that it does not want to negotiate with.
What happens if these talks don't begin January 25th?
That's a good question. As De Mistura indicated, it seems like the world powers are leaving leeway for a little bit of slippage. But the more time goes on and there's no agreement, you lose the momentum that was gained by the International Syrian Support Group that has been meeting in Vienna. You push back the process for implementing the ceasefire, which delays getting humanitarian aid to some of the civilians in need in Syria.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins speaking to us from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. The United Nations has said it will not invite anyone to the talks until major powers promoting the negotiations agree which rebel representatives should attend. Here in Washington, the U.S. Senate rejected legislation restricting America's acceptance of refugees from Syria and Iraq after passionate debate about U.S. security needs and the nation's long history as a destination for the oppressed. Senate Democrats banded together to block debate on a bill requiring the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Director of National Intelligence to certify that Syrian and Iraqi refugees posed no security risk before they could be approved for asylum. Democrat Richard Durbin said the bill was, quote, an effort to stop any Syrian refugee from coming to the United States, regardless of whether it's a mother with a child. Backers of the legislation, which fell 5 votes short of the 60 required to advance, disagreed with Durbin. The House of Representatives passed the measure late last year with bipartisan support. The vote came as the world was reeling from Islamic State-inspired attacks in Paris and amid concerns that terrorists could infiltrate those fleeing horrific violence and brutality. The White House said the legislation was not needed as refugees already undergo an intensive vetting process that can take as long as 2 years. Armed militants stormed a university early Wednesday in northwestern Pakistan, killing at least 20 people. As VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports, many of those who died were students.
The blood of the victims was still splattered in hallways and stairs hours after the attack Wednesday on Bacha Khan University in Charsatta. The bodies of the militants were the last ones to be removed from the campus. Media, both national and international, scrambled to gather information in the boys' hostel that had seen the bloodiest carnage. The victims included a cousin of the hostel warden.
My second cousin only came in for his clearance today. He had already received his degree. His father works for 15 or 20,000 rupees in a private company. He had great hopes for his son. He was cleared from university today, and he died today.
Student Munawar Zaif remembered three friends he used to hang out with.
Yesterday they thought they would be giving an examination the day after. Little did they know they would be killed by these animals.
Campus security says four militants took advantage of the morning fog to cut through a barbed wire barrier and enter the campus to begin their attack. Several students suffered broken bones as they ran and jumped from rooftop to save themselves. One of them, Tasbihullah, saw a gunman take aim at him and shoot.
He was firing as he was climbing the stairs, so I ran to the top floor and jumped. When I landed, I became unconscious, and I woke up on this bed.
Campus security engaged the gunman for a full 45 minutes before police and later the military arrived from nearby towns. The operation lasted several hours. This is where the horror finally ended. Snipers took out the last remaining militants as they were trying to flee through stairs behind this wall. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Charsatta.
The United States and its coalition partners have agreed to intensify their campaign to defeat the Islamic State terrorist group. As Lisa Bryant reports, following talks Wednesday in Paris, the coalition called for a meeting of 26 anti-IS countries next month in Brussels.
The agreement for more aggressive action against Islamic State terrorists was reached in Paris by defense ministers from France, Australia, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Britain, and the United States. The ministers discussed plans to help Iraq and Syria retake two major cities, Mosul and Raqqa, but that was just part of a larger coalition strategy that U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter outlined to eradicate the terrorist group's spread and influence worldwide.
An important part of our discussion today was to talk about all of the capabilities that will be required to succeed here, not just military, but non-military. Non-military being economic in terms of reconstruction, information in terms of countering extremism. When you array all these capabilities, you see how different parties can make stronger contributions, each in their own distinctive way, according to their own strengths.
Pushing more countries to increase their involvement in the fight will be the focus of the Brussels meeting in 3 weeks that Carter says will gather 26 countries, including Iraq. Washington especially wants greater participation from Arab and Asian nations.
Every nation must come prepared to discuss further contributions to the fight. And I will not hesitate to engage and challenge current and prospective members of the coalition as we go forward.
Speaking alongside Carter, French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said ongoing airstrikes have put the Islamic State group in a defensive position, retreating from positions it once held.
Nos efforts conjoints, ainsi que ceux de tous les membres de la coalition, portent leurs fruits.
The coalition's efforts are bearing fruit, Le Drian said, adding for it to be sustainable, the international community needs to increase support for local groups fighting IS so they can retake territory and keep it in the long run. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Coming up, we'll hear from astronaut Scott Kelly, who has spent more time on the International Space Station than any other U.S. astronaut. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute. After a successful satellite launch and international collaboration of oceanographers have a new tool to help them monitor the rise in global sea level. The Jason 3 spacecraft blasted off from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California on January 17. Jason 3 will further efforts to measure global ocean levels that began in 1992 with the TOPICS Poseidon mission. Over the more than 20 years since such satellite measurements began, researchers say the world sea level has risen by 70 millimeters with an annual average increase of about 3 millimeters a year. The Jason 3 mission is a collaboration between NASA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the French Space Agency, CNES, and the European Organization for the Exploitation of Meteorological Satellites. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And I'm David Byrd in Washington. Almost 1 million people who would die of heart disease each year might be saved if they ate a diet rich in so-called healthy fats. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, at the same time, reducing consumption of unhealthy fats could prevent hundreds of thousands of heart disease deaths annually.
Using 2010 data, researchers at Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts, estimated more than 711,000 people died that year because they did not eat enough of the good kinds of fat. Meantime, bad fat, the saturated fat found in meats, cheeses, and palm and coconut oils, led to the heart disease-related deaths of some 250,000 people. Another bad fat, known as trans fat, found in processed foods, was linked with more than 500,000 deaths worldwide. Dariush Mozafarian is Dean of Tufts University School of Nutrition Science and Policy and senior author of the study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. He and his colleagues analyzed data, including diet and food availability information from 186 countries.
So the major priorities for preventing heart disease should be to increase healthful fats and to reduce industrial trans fats.
Looking at trends in fat consumption over time, researchers found recent bans of trans fats in processed food in some countries has led to a reduction in deaths.
In high-income countries like in the U.S. and Western Europe, the burdens due to trans fat are going down, which is consistent with a lot of active policy measures to reduce trans fat in high-income countries. But in middle-income and low-income countries, there's still a lot of deaths from trans fat.
Tropical nations, including the Solomon Islands, Malaysia, and the Philippines, had the highest rates of heart disease deaths linked to consumption of the saturated fats found in processed foods. Countries in the former Soviet Union, in particular Ukraine, were notable for having the greatest number of deaths due to insufficient intake of good fats. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
We all got to listen in to something special today at VOA as reporter Ann Ball spoke with astronaut Scott Kelly. Kelly is aboard the International Space Station and is closing in on the end of a year-long stay. He says that his stay is helping to provide vital information as NASA prepares for planned missions to Mars.
So there are about 400 different scientific experiments going on here throughout the course of the year, and they're in all different scientific disciplines. Some of them, however, are dedicated to our time on board, and those are mostly related to our physiology. There are issues with long-duration spaceflight, and the longer you stay here, the problems that can occur with our physiology increase, such as bone loss and muscle loss, effects on our vision, even our cardiovascular health, effects on from the radiation environment, things like that. And we've done a lot of recording of the data. Last week we had an experiment in the Russian segment that used a lot of the imaging technology we have here on the U.S. segment, but using their device that puts negative pressure on our body to look at the vessels in our head and our heart and our eyes to see if there's an effect on our vision. And all this data that we've been collecting over there, it needs to go down to Earth and analyzed. And it's really not until the scientists have collected it all, will they sit down and take a very close look and see exactly what we've learned and then report on it.
When you look down at Earth and when you look out to space, what do you see?
You do get a sense that you know what's going on Earth and you pay attention to it. And you look down at the Earth, there's a window right down here, and you do feel detached from it. And it does, between those two of those things, just kind of following what's going on very closely and feeling some detached from the planet, you do get a sense that there's a lot of bad stuff going on down there all the time, you know, like the news is mostly bad. And it's, you know, it's really unfortunate and really sad that that's the case. It's really a shame because when we do look down at the Earth, it is such a beautiful place. It's, you know, it's our home, and, you know, it's a home that we need to take care of.
That's astronaut Scott Kelly. If you would like to hear the full conversation, log on to our website, voanews.com. Speaking of caring for the Earth, NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration say that last year's global average temperature was the highest ever by the widest margin on record. Data show that in 2015, the average temperature across global land masses and ocean surfaces was 0.9 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average. This was the fourth time a global temperature record has been set this century. The sharp rise in 2015 was driven in part by El Niño, a natural weather cycle that warms Pacific waters every 2 to 7 years. The latest El Niño started in late 2015 and is expected to last until later this year. And finally tonight, actor Jamie Foxx has played many roles, but he's now being hailed as a real-life hero. Foxx and another man helped pull a man from a burning truck on Monday. The vehicle had rolled into a drainage ditch outside Foxx's house in California. And just seconds after the 32-year-old Brett Kyle was pulled from the truck, the vehicle went up in flames. Jamie Foxx refused to say he was a hero. In his words, he just had to do something. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. Tracy Carter directed our program. Dave Magnus was our engineer. We welcome your questions or comments. You can post them to our website, voanews.com. You can also comment on our Facebook page. That's VOA Asia. And if you are on Twitter, send us a tweet. Our handle is at @VOAIE_IE. For all the folks at VOA, I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Entering its last year in office, the Obama administration has made it clear that engagement with Asia continues to be a top priority, with an agenda that includes economic, security, and political cooperation with Asian partners. In 2016, the United States will push for approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries. The United States will also continue to modernize its alliances and to deepen security relationships with emerging partners. In the Asia-Pacific region, the United States is ready to support its allies in building maritime security, humanitarian disaster relief, and counter-piracy capacity. Maritime security and territorial issues will be clearly on the agenda this year as well, said Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications Ben Rhodes during a recent speech at the Washington Foreign Press Center. The United States is committed to upholding freedom of navigation, he said. On issues like the South China Sea disputes, we'd like to encourage all parties to de-escalate tensions and resolve their issues through international law. The United States will also continue to cooperate with China on issues of common interest. So, for example, last year, one of the biggest issues that we focused on domestically and internationally was climate change, said Mr. Rhodes.
We would not have achieved the Paris Agreement without the cooperation that the United States and China had on that issue, both in terms of the announcement made in Beijing during his last trip and the subsequent cooperation leading into Paris.
We are going to work very closely with China on a whole range of issues related to the Asia-Pacific, said Mr. Rhodes. For example, we'll be working with China through the UN Security Council and also in our own bilateral discussions about how to demonstrate to North Korea that its recent nuclear test and the threat it poses to our allies and to the world will lead to greater costs, consequences, and isolation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.